KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The promise of biotechnology is huge. Researchers at the intersection of human biology and technology are working on cures for many of the worst diseases of our time. And their counterparts in agriculture say they can produce more and cheaper food for our rapidly growing world. But some biotechnology research is controversial, perhaps none more than cloning and genetically modified foods. On this Insight, I'll talk about the risks and dilemmas of biotechnology with author Wesley Smith. His new book is A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. It's about the role big business and moral neutrality play in promoting biotech research that Smith argues is inappropriate or even dangerous. He's in town today for a talk this evening to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento. Wesley Smith, thank you very much for joining us.
Good afternoon, Jeffrey, and thank you for having me.
Well, the phrase Brave New World is usually used ironically, strong, positive words to describe a disturbing future. Do you think that biotechnology is turning our world into a brave new one?
I think it could. A lot of these agendas and a lot of these biotechnologies are actually dual use. On one hand, you can have tremendous benefit, tremendous human healing of terrible diseases. On the other hand, you could end up with a dystopian future of genetic engineering and seeking to, as a group called transhumanists wish to do, re-engineer the human race into a post-human society, which is clear master race thinking and eugenics. So we have to, I think, go forward with research, but I also think we have to engage in very prudent self-restraint.
Well, there are two paths ahead of us. Which way do you think we're headed right now?
I think we're undecided. I think we have reached a very important and crucial crossroads. It's a moral and ethical crossroads. These debates are not science debates as they're sometimes depicted. They're moral and ethical debates. And therefore, one of the things I'm trying to do is to get everybody involved in it, whether one agrees with me or disagrees with my position, because we're all going to obtain the benefits and or consequences of the decisions we make. And I think what you find, not only in the United States, but clearly around the world, is that people are really searching, I think, for the right policies. I do think that you have ideologies on both sides of this issue that are in contest. A lot of people say, well, the scientists are objective. They're no more objective than I am. I think people are trying to decide what's best, and that's why we have to have these discussions. They're very important.
There's a fundamental question early on in your book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, and I'll read it. Does society have the capacity and the will to guide and regulate science so as to keep it on a path that not only improves our lives, but also proceeds with deep respect for the inherent dignity and intrinsic value of our humanity? More bluntly, is your question asking, can we trust scientists?
Partially. I think that has to be true of any profession. Can we trust lawyers? Can we trust doctors? Why should scientists be thought of one way and every other power structure in the society thought of in another way? Can we trust politicians? Can we trust corporations? There have to be checks and balances because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I certainly didn't coin that phrase. And as we get into these issues, I think one of the phenomena that I discovered when I was researching this book and didn't expect to, frankly, was how ideological many in science have become, that rather than being mere objective purveyors of information, pursuing a scientific method that is a good way for determining the nature of the world and how to apply information we receive, that I think in some ways science is being corrupted. So you see, for example, jargon and misstated biology going out there. I remember, and I write about it in Consumer's Guide, the New England Journal of Medicine, which is taking a very strong editorial position in favor of therapeutic cloning, which of course is their right. But then they say, well, you know, what is wrong with these stem cells? We don't want stem cells to become clone babies. But stem cells would never make clone babies. Embryos could make clone babies. And so you see a degeneration sometimes by scientists and by medical professionals of basic biology to win a political debate. And I'm not the only one commenting on this. And throughout the book, I quote people from some of the most professional, as prestigious professional journals in the world, worrying that in order to win these political debates, that scientists in some regard, some, not all certainly, are degrading science by trying, and in fact corrupting it, by trying to turn it into a political movement instead of a objective profession.
My guest is Wesley Smith. He's author of A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. He's written and lectured often on the ethics of medicine and biotechnology. Well, whose job is it to keep ethics and science together? Is that scientists or is it someone or something else?
It's all of our job. You know, we live in a democratic society and a free society. And we, through our democratic processes, create the moral parameters within which all professions, including science, may engage in their activities. For example, after World War II, you had horrors done in the name of science, and the Nuremberg Code came out. Now, from a purely scientific perspective, some of those horrors might have been interesting, but they were moral abominations. And the Nuremberg judges that issued the code said, we're not going to permit this anymore. We're going to have certain moral standards that are going to apply to scientific enterprise. A more recent example would be the Animal Welfare Act. There are things we cannot do to animals, nor should we do, because of the suffering that is caused by these experiments, even though we may be, to some degree, restricting the parameters of science. I submit that if it's okay to have regulations for human experimentation that arose from the Nuremberg Code, and in terms of animals and medical research, we should also be willing and certainly have the right to engage in reasonable regulation of things like human cloning.
Is it appropriate for scientists to introduce morality into their decision making? I know that sounds like a strange question, but the thing is, if scientists are to introduce morality into their work, they have to know whose morality it is. Most of us, I think, agree in the broad strokes of what's moral and what isn't, but we all differ on the details.
Well, that's a good question. What you see a lot happening now in the science establishment is actually scientists are saying that only scientists can say what is moral in science because supposedly only they understand it. Well, that's baloney. All of us are going to be impacted by these decisions, and many of these are very deeply and profoundly moral and ethical. For example, is a cloned human embryo worthy of any dignity and respect, or may we treat it as we would any other natural resource? That's not an issue that science can answer. That is an issue that people deliberating, hopefully with mutual respect and very seriously, in a democratic process, democratic discussion, and through their elected representatives can answer and should answer. And different communities are coming up with different attitudes. For example, in terms of human cloning, Canada has outlawed all somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. Canada, San Francisco is a country. France has outlawed all human somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. That's the most secular free country on the earth. Norway has also. So has Australia. On the other hand, the United Kingdom has gone full speed ahead with therapeutic cloning, authorizing the creation of human life, human organisms, asexually it's called, which is cloning. So that experiments can be done and their researchers can seek medical treatments using cloned human lives. So, that's the discussion the entire world is having, and we're all entitled to participate and should.
There's a science fiction element to some biotechnology, and some experiments that you refer to in your book are bizarre. It seems to be the right word. I'll read them. A biotech company patenting a herd of goats genetically engineered to include spider DNA, so the herds produce milk containing spider web silk. An early embryo that was mostly human but part animal, and a mouse existing with millions of human cells in its brain. Are these just curiosities, or is there something to you that's dark and disturbing in all of this?
Well, I think we have to distinguish between how we experiment with animals and what we do with humans. That's the line I draw. That's my particular moral and ethical belief. I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with what's called transgenic animals. Inherently wrong.
And what is a transgenic
animal? A transgenic animal, this is why Dolly the sheep was created, by the way, so that the people at the Roslin Institute could learn how to genetically engineer cloned sheep so that they would have a human gene which created a certain protein that could then be harvested. It was called farming, P-H-A-R-M-I-N-G. And the idea and the hope, it didn't work out for them because they went bankrupt, but the hope was that they would be able to then milk these goats, or sheep, I'm sorry, and get enough of this protein to make medicines for human use. That's being done both with animals and with plants, and I certainly have no objection to that. But how much is too much? And I don't answer this question in the book, but I do suggest we need to talk about it. How much of human genetic input into animals becomes too much? There's a fellow, the millions of neural cells in the mouse down is down in Stanford University, and Irving Weissman, who is the fellow who's done that, the researcher, suggested in the New York Times in an article called Free to Clone, which is about a potential constitutional right to engage in science, published in the New York Times magazine, that perhaps we should make a mouse with an entire human brain, if that's possible. Now we have to start. Wait, I saw the reaction on your face. Your eyes got big and you were startled. The problem is we get startled, and then a lot of people will come in and rationalize it, saying, well, we could get this out of it and we could get that out of it. And it forces us to consider, what does it mean to be human? Is it important to be human? In fact, I think the question raised by these issues is this one. Does human life have intrinsic value simply and merely because it is human?
And does it?
I believe it does, and I believe it must, that without it, we cannot have universal human equality. Because if we say no to that question, then we have to say, well, then what is it that does give a life value or meaning? And then it becomes an issue of politics. It becomes an issue of who has the power to decide. As an example, in bioethics, and I've been quite a critic of the mainstream bioethics movement, many, if not most, bioethicists are saying being human isn't what gives moral value. It is being, quote, a person, as determined by certain cognitive capacities.
And what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that if it's based on cognitive capacities, according to many of these bioethicists, then infanticide might be acceptable, because the cognitive capacity that many bioethicists, such as Peter Singer at Princeton University, Jonathan Glover, who's a major bioethicist in the UK, they say, well, infanticide should be acceptable since a baby is not self-aware over time for about a year. And therefore, since they're not persons, then they have less moral stature than a normal adult human would have who would be a person. It also might lead to the victimization and, frankly, harvesting of people with serious cognitive disabilities. There are very serious discussions happening right now in the transplant community, in high bioethics, and books are being written about whether or not we should be able to take somebody diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state and kill them for their organs. Now, when you start considering doing that or redefining death to include that diagnosis, so now we can say we're not killing them for their organs. But when you start thinking about doing that, you are thinking about treating some humans as a harvestable crop. But you're literally saying that their humanity isn't what counts. It's their cognitive capacities. And that means today you and I could walk out the door of this radio station, get hit by a car, suffer a serious brain injury, and we lose our human equality.
My guest is Wesley Smith, the attorney and author of A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. If humans, though, are exceptional and different, and animals clearly are less than that, because you, in your opinion, transgenic animals are okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't that say then that humans are just better? And
yeah. What's the problem with saying that humans have greater value than animals?
Well, I guess if you're a human, clearly it's natural you'd think that you have a greater value. But I think most people think that some kind of animal research and experimentation, some degree, is acceptable. Clearly not all people do. But why is it ethically okay to decide that a creature that can't speak is lower than you?
Well, this gets us into a huge discussion of human exceptionalism. Are you wearing leather shoes?
Yes, I am.
Well, then you've decided that cows have less value than you, because I bet you, Jeffrey, you
Indeed.
Would never wear human shoes made out of human skin.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah. And we look at what the Nazis did, and certainly I'm not making any Nazi analogies. I want to be real clear about that. But when the Nazis made lampshades out of human skin, it was abhorrent. Yet people for the ethical treatment of animals has said, and we're getting off the topic of cloning, but they have said in their Holocaust on a Plate campaign, which is promoting vegetarianism, that those of us who wear leather shoes and eat meat are basically no better than the Nazi concentration camp guards. That moral equivalence is so beyond, it seems to me, the moral realm of acceptable discourse and is so denigrating of what happened in the Holocaust that it should be beyond the pale, but it isn't, which means that not in animal liberation and in the issues we're talking about here, does being human matter? Just because we're human is perhaps the most important discussion to be held in the next century, because the morality of our society and the policies that we will establish over a wide variety of areas of import will be determined by how we decide that issue.
What about primates? They are animals. They're not humans. But it certainly, in terms of appearance, in terms of their intellect, of their social behavior, they are the closest animals to humans. Mm-hmm. Is it okay, in your opinion, to have transgenic primates?
Well, if it doesn't hurt the primate, probably. Here's how I look at these issues. First off, I think we have to wall off humans from that discussion about who has greater value, who has lesser value. Otherwise, we end up with a new eugenics. The problem with eugenics was that the eugenicists of the 19th and 20th century, which most were, by the way, progressives and were not conservatives, people like Teddy Roosevelt, people like Margaret Sanger, people like even Helen Keller, Clarence Darrow, who was my hero growing up, was a major eugenicist. But the problem with that was that they decided that unlike Jefferson, they didn't believe that each and every one of us was created equal. And they created a distinction between the fit and the unfit. And they tried to, without getting into the entire history, promote the better humans and discourage the procreation of the lesser humans, which led to the involuntary sterilization in the United States of between 60 and 70,000 people in the first 40 to 50 years of eugenics. It ended up with the Supreme Court in 1927 in Buck v. Bell, which I think should go down in history with Dred Scott decision, saying three generations of idiots is enough, permitting the involuntary sterilization of a woman whose only crime was to be raped by her foster cousin and give birth to a child out of wedlock. Now, with the ability coming with because of cloning, if we do cloning, then the next step after the stem cell research may well be how to genetically engineer the human race. We are returning to eugenics thinking, what is better, what is less valuable, and only this time our eugenics could have teeth in it because we are literally potentially learning how to change human nature at the molecular level. In terms of the animals, I think we have to look at what is the human benefit that we hope to receive or other benefit. What is the capacity, to the best of our knowledge, of that animal to suffer? And if you take a look at what we have often called the higher animals, dolphins, primates, their ability, because of their intelligence, to suffer is probably, or we have always thought, higher than, say, that of a mouse. Now, the PETA listeners out there will tell me I'm a human racist and that I want animals to suffer and I'm an awful, awful person. But I think that is the kind of weighing and balancing that we need to go through. But keep humans out of it, because otherwise universal human equality is at risk.
This is Insight from KXJZ. Today we're talking about the morality of biotechnology with author Wesley Smith. His latest book is A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to today's show and any other Insight Archive program on our website. Go to capradio.org/insight. My guest is Wesley Smith, author of A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. It's about morality and science. Wesley Smith has written often on the ethics of medicine and technology, and he's speaking tonight at 6 o'clock to the World Affairs Council of Sacramento. I'd like to read another short excerpt from your book.
This is really novel. A host has read my book. This is great.
Well, we do our best. You wrote, "No one objects to researching the use of adult tissues and stem cells. Such research may reap most of the medical benefits sought by advocates of human cloning, with none of the moral cost." But my question for you is there a moral cost when a disease goes uncured because the path toward the cure is blocked by something that is itself immoral or at least morally questionable?
Let me try to understand exactly what you're asking. Are you saying that is there a moral cost if we might have had a treatment, but that the path to that treatment is potentially immoral?
Yes.
Well, that's the question of after the Holocaust. There was some information derived. And again, I'm not making there's no equivalence between the Holocaust and cloning, okay?
Yes.
But this issue has come up before. Where there was some information, potentially valuable information, gained from those immoral experiments during the awful death camps. And the question then becomes, and this argument's still being held today, do you use that information thereby gained, which is unequivocally immoral, or do you say, look, because even though it was immoral, look at the benefit we can gain from that? There's no easy answer to that kind of question. I've talked to a fellow named Michael Franzblau, who is a Nazi hunter, a physician Nazi hunter, and he believes, I think I'm quoting him correctly, that no, you don't use that information because to use that information is to somehow reward the immoral behavior. Other people say, well, the information's here now, not to use it is immoral. And I think you'd have to do a case-by-case question on that. What I believe in terms of therapeutic cloning and cloning in general, I believe it turns human life into a product. I think it turns procreation into manufacture. I can almost guarantee you that in 20 years, they won't be talking about just using cloned embryos in petri dishes. New Jersey, for example, has already legalized somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning, allow implantation of those cloned embryos into wombs. They did that by not making that against the law. That which is not illegal is by definition legal. And they permit gestation through the ninth month. Now, that was not done by accident. That was done on purpose, because when people objected to that legislation, saying, among other things, four members of the President's Council on Bioethics wrote a letter to then-Governor McGreevy, listen, this could permit fetal farming. Instead of altering that legislation, for example, to outlaw implantation the way the Dianne Feinstein Orrin Hatch bill would, they just took it off the floor, waited for the heat to cool down, and then at the end of the 2003 session, put it back out for a snap vote and passed it. And it was signed into law in January of 2004. Texas, there was identical legislation tried and did not get through. Illinois just lost by one vote in last fall to have a bill that would have allowed cloning through the ninth month as well. So I see two things happening. Number one is you've got this now because of Proposition 71, this incredible Oklahoma land race kind of people, states falling over each other to offer corporate welfare, biotech grants to biotech companies to, oh, please come to our state, we'll give you whatever you want. And at the second time, they're just creating these almost wide open, as in New Jersey, moral licenses that I think the researchers want for reasons that they cannot yet achieve technologically. In fact, I have quotes from some bioethicists and others, some of which I quote in the book, saying, well, the supposed 14-day limit, which is in place in California, is temporary. And Proposition 71 said that the extent to which you could keep these cloned embryos alive for experimentation shall initially be 12 days. The word initially is in there so that it can expand. So this is not just about stem cells and embryos in petri dishes. This is going to be, especially when you get an artificial womb in about 5 to 10 years, it's going to be about much more than that. And people have to decide whether treating, for example, fetuses like commodities is moral or is immoral.
When you say it, Proposition 71,
right,
the stem cell research, when you say that it is going to lead to much more, is that because it's an inexorable path, regardless of what the intentions of the people behind it are? Or are you saying that the people who are behind it actually had darker intentions?
Well, I'm glad you think they're darker intentions. I think
I'm not saying they are darker.
A lot of people would say those aren't darker intentions. I think that what happens is you end up, when you create a first principle in your mind, then it leads to certain places. I mean, there's a force of gravity at work based on what our belief systems are. I certainly believe, and I want to make this clear, that people who are engaged, who disagree with my moral views and my ethical views, but they're very well-intentioned people. They are people who really want to alleviate human suffering. I don't think there's any question about that. There are also people who want to get very rich doing so. There are also people with ideological views, particularly this idea of science as salvation. Nothing is that black and white. Everything is very complex. But I do think that once you come to the conclusion that it is all right to create human life for the purpose of researching it and destroying it, which is what therapeutic cloning does, and you say, well, for now, we're not going to allow it to be implanted. Well, what difference does implantation make if you believe, remember we were talking earlier about personhood theory, if you believe that being human, a human organism, isn't what gives value, but it is level of consciousness, well, a 2-month-old or a 3-month-old developed fetus is no more conscious than an embryo, at least as far as we can tell. So if that's the justification for doing therapeutic cloning, then why not do organ harvesting from cloned fetuses, which, by the way, has already been done in animal experiments?
Reasonable people can differ on stem cell research.
Indeed.
And the different kinds of stem cell research, and also on whether it was a good idea for California to issue bonds for $3 billion to fund this kind of research, whether the government should be involved in
Indeed.
This, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Setting that aside, why do you think stem cells became the cause du jour in American political life, where people felt obliged to have a strongly held opinion on something that they didn't even, in many cases, fully understand and certainly didn't know about not too long ago?
Because it deals, I think, with the most essential questions that we face as humans, which some of which we've been talking about this afternoon. Being human important? It got involved, although I think it's factually irrelevant, but it also got involved politically with the abortion issue. The reason I think it's factually irrelevant is that abortion is legal, according to the Supreme Court, because the law is not going to tell a woman to do with her body that which she does not wish to do. It's, you know, the term choice. With cloning, no woman is being forced to do anything with her body. So the issue of abortion is irrelevant. But it's not, because people who support the abortion right are afraid that if we say that there's moral value to the embryo, it could affect abortion. People who oppose abortion hope that if we find a moral value to embryos, that it could affect abortion. But I suggest we shouldn't look at every issue that comes down the pike through the abortion prism, but we should look at each of these issues based on its own merits and demerits and come to a decision, regardless of whether it might conceivably have an effect on abortion.
We did a show on the stem cell initiative a couple of months back, and one of our guests, unfortunately, it was right at the end of the show, didn't have time to develop it, but it was someone from the California Nurses Association that was opposed to Prop 71.
Right.
And they had many reasons why they were against it. One of them was the potential for the exploitation of women.
Absolutely. That's a huge issue.
And in your book, you write that there is a women's rights angle to cloning because of the need for eggs.
Right. And this is something that I would really like to see the mainstream media get much more involved in. I've got here, in fact, I bring it with me. This is something called Therapeutic Cloning in the Mouse. This is published in the 100% Mouse. Did I say mouth? Therapeutic Cloning in the Mouse, 100 Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, September 30, 2003, by Peter Momberts, Mombaerts. He's a cloning researcher with mice at Rockefeller University. And what he pointed out in this article, and I think it's really important to this question, is that it would probably take 100 eggs per patient just to get one usable cloned embryonic stem cell line. And let me very quickly backtrack. Here's how you do somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. You take a human egg, you take out the nucleus. You take, let's say you're going to do me. You take one of my skin cells, you take out the nucleus, you put my skin cell nucleus into the egg where the nucleus used to be. Now we have a genetically modified egg that has 46 chromosomes, which is the human essential amount number, and it also is a mature egg that has the capacities within it to create embryonic development. You then zap it with electricity, and if the cloning works, which it mostly doesn't, then you have a new embryo. And if it was me, it would be a new human embryo. If it was Dolly, she was a sheep embryo before she was a lamb and then a sheep. That's somatic cell nuclear transfer. So you have three essential ingredients. You have somatic cells, which are almost all the cells in our body except our germ cells. We all have trillions. We have electricity, which in this state on occasion has been a problem, but that's usually not going to be a problem. But then you also have a problem of eggs. How are you going to get all of the eggs that would be required to...
Women have a very limited number of eggs in their body.
Well, to get them is hard. They actually have many, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not eggs in their body. But how are you going to get them? Because they only release one per month. The way you get them is called superovulation. And in that, you give women of childbearing age very strong hormones so that instead of releasing one egg in a cycle, they release 10 to 20. This is not an easy process for women. I mean, you just think about what you're putting the body through. And it can have serious side effects, such as an ovary going up to the size of a grapefruit. You can have infection. You can have sterility. On occasion, you can have death. And these eggs are extracted with a needle through the vaginal wall. It's not something that is fun. As a consequence, right now, just to have eggs for in vitro fertilization, these eggs, which I think have become the most valuable commodity on the planet pound for pound, because they're very tiny, obviously, they sell for about $1,000 a piece. That's without the incredible demand of 100 million patients in America alone who might want therapeutic cloning if it could be developed. Now, let's do a little basic math. If Peter Mombertz, who is pro-cloning, is right, and it would take 100 eggs per patient just to get one usable embryonic stem cell line, and you have 100 million Americans who would like that treatment, that's 10 billion eggs. I mean, that's ludicrous. It's not going to happen. If you rationed it to 100,000 of the sickest patients, that's still 10 million eggs. You're never going to get them in the United States. You're not going to have women in San Francisco lining up month after month to do this procedure with the kind of potential discomfort that it causes and potential side effects. So what might happen? Kenya. Women in Bangladesh. We already now know that poor people in developing countries are exploited for their organs. Some people sell their kidneys in order to buy their kids some surgery. And what the feminists are concerned about, and I share their concern, is that what we would do is we would go over to Kenya, pay a lot less money than you'd have to pay here in the United States for women to go through this superovulation. And then if there were side effects, there wouldn't be the medical treatment available to them if problems arose. Plus, you'd break the bank because Peter Mombertz says this process for the eggs alone, and remember, he's pro-cloning, is $100,000 to $200,000. That would bust Medicare. It would break the HMO bank. And so you know who'd get this treatment? George Soros and Bill Gates and the hyper-rich and members of Congress. But you know who wouldn't get it? You and me.
My guest is Wesley Smith. This is Insight. We're talking about the moral dilemmas posed by biotechnology. And he's the author of A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. It seems that both liberals and conservatives have their concerns about biotechnology, but they tend not to overlap. The people opposed to genetically modified crops are rather different, politically at least, from the people who oppose stem cell research. Why do so many liberals and conservatives have their own rather selective positions in biotechnology?
This has been driving me crazy because one of the things I've been trying to do in my work on this issue as well as other issues is build bridges between conservative and liberals who might agree with me. Now, I'm often called very conservative, but I've co-authored four books with Ralph Nader. You know, it's like, what? Yeah, I'm a conservative? Well, you know, people label people. I think that liberals, I'll be honest with you, I've been very disappointed in the left in this because I think there's a lot of intellectual shallowness there. They've gotten so defensive that it's almost like their first instinct is to see, well, what do the pro-lifers think? And well, I'll think the opposite. You know, so if the pro-lifers are against cloning, I'm for it. or if the pro-lifers don't like stem cell research, I'm for it. They allow people who they really disdain to basically control their own thinking, which is giving an awful lot of power to people you don't like. I've had to deal with the same issue when I've talked to people who are conservative and pro-life, and I've done this mainly in opposing assisted suicide. And it took some time, but you know, from my perspective, they've come around the pro-life movement to working with people who disagree with them about abortion. So in the assisted suicide issue, which is going to be an issue in this state as legislation's about to be introduced, the strongest opponents you're going to find are disability rights activists who are liberal politically and secular in their outlook, medical professionals who are definitely pro-choice in terms of abortion, and they'll be working side by side with pro-life people who tend to be religious in their outlook, conservative, and against abortion. But in that issue, you will see a coalition because it's been going on now for 10 years. On the cloning issue, I've been trying to help build the same kinds of coalition, and it's been harder going.
If we are to impose strict ethical constraints in biotechnology, that would presumably mean regulating an industry. What's your general position on regulating industry?
Well, I guess I take the Naderite position that industry should be regulated. I think all powerful areas of society need checks and balances. I think that's the genius of the American system. And of course, you don't want to regulate it to the point where it's completely stifled. And we have to understand that when it comes to these biotechnological issues we've been discussing this afternoon, most biotechnology is not controversial. I mean, we've talked about adult stem cells, which are already, by the way, in human trials for heart disease, multiple sclerosis. In Portugal, they've been doing tremendous work for spinal cord injury using nasal stem cells from olfactory tissues. But beyond that, for example, there are companies trying to use our knowledge of the human genome to create cancer drugs that would be tailored to each individual's genetic makeup. Nobody opposes that. Orrin Hatch, Dianne Feinstein on one side and Sam Brownback of Kansas on the other disagree about therapeutic cloning, but they are co-sponsoring legislation to create an umbilical cord blood stem cell bank so that federal money could be put into that issue to provide for this incredible cornucopia of medical therapies that come with each baby that is born. So it's I forgot your original question, but
well, it was just about regulating business.
But so, yeah, it's a matter of there's a dynamic tension. You want to have a certain amount of liberty, of course. On the other hand, these things have incredible societal impact, and therefore the society has the right to regulate. Right now, as I mentioned earlier, as reported in this Free to Clone article from the New York Times Magazine, and just a couple of days ago, supported by the San Jose Mercury News in an editorial, some are claiming there's a right in the First Amendment to conduct research, which would mean there would be no meaningful regulation of science. And in my view, if that ever came to pass, science would cease to serve society and come to dominate it. So that's going to be an issue we have to face in the near future.
Is this where the issue becomes a little difficult for conservatives? If a social conservative has perhaps concerns about the value of life, Economic conservatives tend to like to stay away from regulating business.
Yep. These biotech issues they are not easily divided, conservative, liberal, secular, religious. They cut a diagonal. You have conservatives like Orrin Hatch in favor of therapeutic cloning. You have pro-choice Democrats like Mary Landrieu, who has urged that all human cloning be banned. As I said earlier, Canada has outlawed human cloning. Canada is a very liberal country. France has. It's a very secular country. The UK permits therapeutic cloning. So it's the usual suspects, if you will, to use that wonderful term out of Casablanca. It doesn't work in this issue because you find a very heterodox lineup on both sides, pro and con.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to talk about where you come from fundamentally in this. Is your position on biotech and bioethics motivated by religious belief?
No, it's motivated by a deep desire to maintain universal human equality, which I believe is necessary, which I believe you must believe in human exceptionalism in order to maintain that. I do develop that we don't have time to get into it totally now, but I developed that in Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World and a lot of my other work. If you look at my website, www.wesleyjsmith.com, I've got a lot of articles. And right now, it appears that I'm taking conservative sides of these debates, but that's only because these debates have been caricatured by the media in a way that I think is two-dimensional. This is not a conservative versus liberal. This is, again, back to the issue, does human life have intrinsic value simply because it's human? And I believe that if we say no to that question, you're going to end up with some humans who are exploited, oppressed, and even killed.
Wesley Smith, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. It was a very interesting talk. Thank you, Jeffrey.
That's Wesley Smith, author of A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. And he's speaking at the World Affairs Council of Sacramento this evening. This is Insight from KXJZ. When we return, something rather different, how the city of Sacramento is rooting through recycling bins at random and rewarding good recyclers with a $100 check. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, we'll look at the state of Lake Tahoe. It's warming at almost twice the rate of the world's oceans. Experts who are studying the phenomenon will join me in the studio to talk about the implications of warming for the lake and the economy of the region. Next week on Insight, I'll talk with novelist John Lacroix and look at the new law that gives marriage-like benefits to gays in California. There was a funny item in Walt Wiley's column in some zoned editions of the Sacramento Bee this morning about one way the city of Sacramento is trying to motivate people to clean up their recycling bins. The guy who does the close-up research joins us. He's Michael Root, a program analyst with the city's solid waste division. Michael, thanks for joining us.
No problem, Jeffrey.
Well, Michael, you arrive at people's homes with a reward, but you don't just take their word about the cleanliness of their recycling. What do you do?
We select council districts, and then we go into neighborhoods and randomly choose a residence recycling container. We put a tag on their door alerting them that we have selected them for the program, and then we actually look through the recycling container to see if there is only recyclables in that container.
You said you select randomly. Can people be nominated?
No, this is a random selection. What has happened is two organizations, the Sacramento Area Earth Day Network and the Sacramento Recycling and Transfer Station, have donated $1,200 each to the city for this program. And so that's enough funds for us to be in each council district three times a year and select a resident from that council district at random for the program. So we go into neighborhoods. We're selecting folks that only have the recycling container out, and then we just simply choose them at random and look through their can.
How many cans have you looked at so far?
So far, we've looked through, let me see, this is the third month of the program. Tomorrow, I'll look at my sixth can.
And what have you found so far? Has it been gratifying?
It's been fun. Somewhat disappointing. The thing that caused most people to lose out on the prize is they've, placed food waste in their container.
And that's a no-no for recycling.
Exactly. The program, we build the program as if it's clean and dry, toss it in. And so food waste is wet waste, does not belong in a recycling container. It's a, source of contamination.
What exactly happens? Why does that spoil the recycling process?
It doesn't so much spoil the recycling process. We're past the days where if somebody put something that was wrong in the recycling container, you would, contaminate a whole load of recyclables. What it does do is it adds cost to the city's program. The recyclables that we collect are collected as mixed recycling. So you have we're asking residents to sort their recyclables from the trash. And so when they sort the recycling, the companies that process the material, they're looking to high-grade the material to get the most value from it. The higher the market value, the better the city gets paid for the recyclables also. Contaminants, add cost. That material is basically trash. It has to be disposed of at a higher rate. So it costs, you know, the city, therefore its ratepayers, money. This program is aimed at encouraging recycling, but also, you know, getting the word out about putting the right stuff in the right can to decrease the contamination rate.
This is Michael Root with the City of Sacramento Solid Waste Division. Sacramento used to have these crates, and you'd put your newspapers in one crate and you'd put your bottles in another crate and so on. And then to encourage people, to make it easier for people to recycle, you went to these large bins where you could just toss it all in. Have things gotten worse since you went to the one bin approach?
You know, I would say things have gotten better.
Really?
In the old days, under the three bin system, it was cumbersome. You know, many residents, because of the mechanisms for recycling, the three bins, you know, had a hard time lugging those things out to the curb on a biweekly basis for recycling.
But
we were doing about 12,000 tons of recyclables each year.
But what about the cleanliness of the recycling? Has that gotten worse since?
You know, I don't think so. You know, the technology has changed, and certain issues like, you know, damp paper and things like that aren't the issues that we have to deal with today. Broken glass isn't the issue that we have to deal with today. Things that were fears under early programs. When the city of Sacramento, you know, first proposed to go to a curbside recycling program, the desire of the solid waste professionals working for the city was to do a mixed recycling program right off the get-go. You know, we're really not for the three-bin system. Kind of get hammered by, you know, some of the environmental community because of that. But we saw that type of collection as being both efficient from a solid waste point of view and also easy to participate in from a residential point of view. And our current experience really bears that out. I mean, we went from 12,000 tons a year to over 36,000 tons this year of curbside recyclables.
I know when I put all my recyclables into one container, I can't help but wonder who on earth or what on earth is sorting all this. How does it work?
It's a combination of mechanical and manual sorting. You know, a great place to visit is the Sacramento Recycling and Transfer Station. It's where the city has both its waste transferred to landfill, but also it's where the recyclables are processed. And it's a marvelous operation. They use high-speed paper sorters to handle most of the paper, which is, again, it's the largest percentage of the recyclable stream. Cardboard is handled mechanically, and then other items are sorted manually to increase value.
But that's got to be labor-intensive.
You know, it is and it isn't. Remember that, you know, most of your curbside recyclables are made up of paper, and that's handled by the high-speed sorters. So mechanically, those items are sorted out of the recyclable stream. And what's left is the bottles, the cans, the plastic, the glass, and those things are sorted by hand.
How much recyclable material is getting thrown out now because it's spoiled?
You know, we have about an 18% contamination rate, which for a program of our size really isn't that bad. You know, of course, the less contamination, the better the revenue to the city is. But, you know, on a whole, the contamination rate isn't that bad. We'd like to see it, you know, of course, be better.
And in our last minute, let's return to the award program. How do people know if their bin was, if their recycling can was looked at?
We put a door hanger on their door and ask them to call us. And we're asking folks whether they have, you know, one or not to call in and find out how they've done. They simply give me a telephone call. They need to call me within 24 hours of being selected. And I let them know if they've won. And if they have, we make arrangements for with their council member to award them the prize.
And it's like the lottery. If no one wins, it keeps adding up.
It gets better and better and better. Tomorrow when I go into Council District 2, the resident that's selected has the opportunity to win $500 just
wow.
for having the right stuff in the right can.
So Council District 2 in Sacramento, make sure your bins are nice and accessible and visible.
That's exactly right. We'll be there tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much. Michael Root, pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey.
That's Michael Root, Program Analyst for the City of Sacramento Solid Waste Division. And that's Insight for today. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, most of Sri Lanka's foreign income comes from an unlikely place, the Middle East. Nearly a million Sri Lankans are immigrant workers there and send their earnings home. But the tsunami is changing that. That story and the day's news are next on The World. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. The waters of Lake Tahoe are warming at almost twice the rate of the world's oceans. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On the next Insight, I'll speak with experts about what it means and the impact it'll have on the lake, its clarity, and the economy of the region. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.